Today's ICEYE Flyby show takes a first look into perhaps the most important issue facing humanity today, climate change. To discuss this existential challenge, our guest today is Professor Joanna Haig. Until she retired recently, Joanna was Professor of Atmospheric Physics at Imperial College London and co-director of the world-renowned Grantham Institute for Climate Change and the Environment. We want to focus on perhaps the most important question of all. Is it too late to save planet Earth? Our fascinating discussion takes us through climate change denial, the underlying proof of human-caused climate change, and some of the possible ways to ameliorate change. Her message is sobering, but she believes that we all need to act right now for the planet and its human cargo to stand a chance of avoiding serious damage in the future. Steel yourself, but stay positive and ready for action. Okay, welcome, Joanna. Thank you very much for joining us today. The issue of climate change is probably the most profound existential issue that is facing us and the planet at the moment. I think our listeners would love to know whether what we're talking about here in terms of controlling climate change is just about controlling carbon emissions.
In order to know how to address a problem, we've got to know what's causing it in the first place and what it's due to. And to cut to the chase, I mean, the largest, by far the biggest contribution to recent what's been called global warming is carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases emitted by human activities. And so the number one thing we've got to do is stop emitting the greenhouse gases. But there are other things that we can do to mitigate and adapt to the effects.
How can you be sure that it's about human activity that's causing this?
Oh, well, there's several ways of knowing this. For a start, the records we have of the measurements of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere show that it's now higher than it has been for 3 million years.
Oh, my goodness.
And so that's before all the continents were in the same place and everything on Earth was completely different. We also can tell that it's come from fossil fuel combustion by doing carbon dating of the carbon in the atmosphere, and it's getting older. That's because it's coming from fossil fuels. We can also tell it's down to human activity by looking at the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere. Now, this sounds scary, but it's not scary at all, but the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere is going down by a very, very small amount, but that's because it's being eaten up by the fossil fuel combustion. So we can look at the measures of the climate, we can look at of the temperature, we can look at the measures of carbon dioxide, we've got the physics, we can explain the changes, and it can't be due to anything else but human emissions of greenhouse gases.
And that's what, certain to 99.9%?
Well, I'm not going to put at least 90%, anyway, 95%, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Of course, there's natural factors, of course, affecting the climate as well. So you can't say that every single change in the climate is down to human activity. And when you start getting to just looking at regional and local effects, of course, it's a whole different picture because you get all sorts of noisy weather effects. But if you're just looking at global average temperature over the last at least 50 years, the warming is down to human activity by, I would say, 99%.
So we're talking about a rise of, I think I read something around 1.6 degrees centigrade over the last 150 years. Would you agree with that?
It's not quite that bad yet.
No.
I think it's about 1.25 at the moment.
Right. But still quite a profound increase compared to what it was before.
Yes. I mean, people think that 1.5 or 1.25 degrees doesn't sound like very much. And of course, if you look night and day, summer and winter, 1.5 degrees is nothing. But if you look at a global annual average of temperature, it is significant. Yes.
Well, I was just curious as well. In terms of global warming, of course, we also experience record lows at winter in terms of minus across the UK sometimes. And it's concerning, but also how is that related to climate change if we are experiencing higher global warming temperatures?
So the first thing that needs to be clarified is the difference between climate and weather. So we all experience the weather every day. And today, where I am in Sussex, it's blowing and it's cold and it's rainy. But that doesn't say anything particular about what the general climate is in the south of England. So the weather is what we experience locally on a day-to-day or hour-to-hour basis. But the climate is the sort of average, typical weather over an area, over perhaps an average of 3 months or something like that. So when we talk about climate change, we have to be very careful about what we mean. We may go on to talk about extreme weather if we get onto that. And that's that's another aspect of climate change. But in terms of global warming, that sort of climate change, it's a large scale and longer period changes. So that's what we're talking about. When we talk about regional variations, then of course there's scope for much larger variability. So for example, in the UK, a lot of our weather is driven across the Atlantic by the jet stream, which is winds high up in the atmosphere, driving the weather patterns, which impinge on us, and they will be responsible for what we're experiencing. And it does seem that climate change is responsible for perhaps pushing the jet stream a bit. Now, if that's the case, places that are on the north side of the jet stream will get colder, and places that are on the south side of the jet stream will get warmer, because that's the way that the pattern works. Yeah. So it's not that everywhere is warming by exactly the same amount. You can also see, for example, if you look at the temperature data, that the global warming is 1.25 degrees over that since whatever it is, 1850. But the warming is much larger, especially at high latitudes and in the Arctic, where it's several degrees already. Whereas in lower latitudes and over the oceans, the changes are smaller. So it depends where you are, how you're experiencing it at the moment.
And is that down to global wind patterns, or is there some other force at work which makes the extreme north and south warm up faster?
There's two basic reasons. One relates to wind patterns and how the energy that comes in from the sun is moved from low latitudes to high latitudes. Yeah. And that involves changes in the atmospheric circulations, which are influenced by climate change. So the other thing that happens is that at high latitudes, you have a very bright ice and snow surfaces, which tend to reflect the sunshine to space. That reduces the warming that you would get otherwise.
Yeah.
But when you get global warming, that tends to melt the ice and then makes the surfaces darker. And that means you get more absorbed solar radiation. And so the effect is worse where you have icy surfaces than other places.
So the global temperature warming, if it carries on the way it is going at the moment, if we don't do anything about the emissions, what's going to happen?
Well, certainly the global warming will go ahead. And also all the other impacts of climate change that we're now beginning to see more and more, and to put it scientifically, very scary, will carry on. So, you know, the sort of weather that saw temperatures in Siberia last year in 38 degrees in extraordinary temperatures, and forest fires. Yeah. And the current floods in Pakistan, all these things, you can't say on a one-to-one basis that is due to climate change, but we know that those sorts of events are going to be more likely under climate change. And so that's what will happen. It'll just go on getting warmer globally, but all these things will get much worse. So it's not just me sitting in East West Sussex is going to get 1 degree warmer every year. It means all the weather patterns are going to change, the precipitation is going to change, the clouds and all the rest of it. And we'll be in a different situation.
One of the problems, I guess, is that human beings are adapted to a very narrow range of livable conditions. And what you're talking about, I think, is that even on a local level, that range of conditions is going to be expanded. It's going to become more extreme.
Yes, I think you have to be a bit more precise than that, but you're right. Mm. And of course, if you look at the climate change in, for example, in Africa, the temperatures are now getting to such a state that it's just not possible for humans to work outside. I mean, it because it's so hot. On the other hand, you might say that people who are suffering from very cold temperatures in Canada or something will be better off because it won't be so
warm
cold. And maybe the agriculture in that area will be improved. So it's not all unremittingly worth. There's some winners and some losers, but overall, I think it's definitely not a good idea.
No.
As the situation as it stands, then, do you feel like it is reversible if we were to take action now?
Reversible, I think, is extremely unlikely.
Right.
I mean, reverse the trend, maybe slow down the warming. I think to get back to where we were would just be impossible. Pretty much impossible. In either to slow down the warming, we need to act now because it's the whole system slow. Mm. Now, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is suggesting that we need to keep global temperatures to temperature increase to less than 2 degrees and preferably better than less than 1.5 degrees, because low-lying islands in the Indian Ocean and places will probably get inundated at more than about 1.5 degrees.
Yeah.
And the studies that climate scientists have done using most up-to-date models have shown to limit temperatures to 1.5 degrees by the end of this century means peaking carbon emissions now, reducing them to half what they are by 2030. You know, that's not really and getting them to zero by 2050. So you see the challenge. To be honest, it's now looking very difficult to keep things under 1.5 degrees, because we were quite hopeful after Glasgow that maybe countries would be doing more, but the international situation is now so difficult that I think it's very difficult to see how that can take place.
Which means that future generations are going to have to cope with some pretty awful weather conditions.
That's right. So the whole question then comes around to not just what we call mitigation, which is trying to make it less bad, but also adaptation. So in climate circles for a while, it was sort of not proper to talk about adaptation because it suggested that you'd accept that was going to be global warming. But now we realise, of course, that adaptation is absolutely key, and some parts of the world will have to adapt pretty quickly and in order to live with what's going on. So how to do that and also the whole question about who pays for it is a whole big area of current policy discussion.
You don't place much faith on carbon sequestration then?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, I think we're in such a situation now that if we're going to get to net zero by 2050 or even trying to do it, we're not going to do it we're not going to do it entirely by stopping burning carbon. We're going to try and do as much as we can in stopping burning. But really, to get to net zero, we're going to have to do some sequestration. And that's sort of beggars all sorts of questions in terms of what technologies to use, where to store the carbon that's going to keep it there forever. Neither finance. Now, you might argue, I would argue, that the chief causes of global warming are fossil fuel combustion, and the fossil fuel companies are raking in the profits, and they should be doing the sequestration. But there's absolutely no incentive on them to do it. There's nobody giving them any tax relief or subsidies or incentives to do the sequestration, so they won't do it. I have to say there's some exceptions to that rule. The Norwegian oil company has been doing sequestration for a while, but they need to do it large scale and now and be forced to do it in order to help get us back to where we hope to be by 2050.
Yeah. I mean, just to make it clear to the listeners, sequestration means taking carbon out of the atmosphere, converting it to some sort of solid or liquid, and then storing it deep underground where it's not going to get released into the atmosphere again. Is that a fair?
That's right. That's the sort of industrial sequestration, and that's what we'd expect the fossil fuel companies to be doing. Of course, as part of that, there's other aspects that you can do. So you could, there's one that's quite popular in some of the literature called biofuels with carbon capture and storage. Mm. So where you grow plants, you burn them to produce energy.
Yeah.
So you've got your energy that you're trying to get out of the fuels.
Yeah.
And then you capture the carbon. And so you've got the energy, but you stored the carbon. So it's not just one or the other. So that's
okay.
There's also, as you're suggesting, a sort of direct air capture, which would be from fossil, from a fuel, there'll be, what would it called, fuel combustion towers. So you capture the carbon from those emissions and capture them. Of course, you can think about storing not just in rocks, but in the biosphere. So people argue that, you know, you should be just growing more trees and things.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, no harm in planting a few trees unless you plant them where somebody else is trying to grow food. And you've got to grow the right sort of trees in the right sort of places and make sure that it's a possibility of keeping that thing going, and that'll stop after a while if you don't. Possibilities of storing it deep in the oceans, even storing it in the built environment. You know, we have building materials that could be used to store. So all these are interesting ideas, but none of them is properly and fully developed and costed and paid for. Something will need to be done in that line.
I was just going to ask if there's any other alternative methods, such as, like you say, planting trees. Would that at all be helpful in those scenarios? Because, of course, we all know oxygen is produced by plants after taking in carbon dioxide, but I imagine that's a significantly slower process.
So, I mean, doing things for the natural environment and biodiversity, of course, is a good thing in its own right, and indeed associated with climate change, but sort of separate, is the whole crisis in biodiversity at the moment. And we need to think what we're doing in the natural world and how to mitigate that as well. So some of these things, like growing trees, will be good. Making more green spaces in cities, looking after the quality of our air and our water, all those things will not only help with the environment, but will also help with climate change.
The way that it's going at the moment, young people seem to be particularly keen, which I would expect because it's their future that's being threatened at the moment, whereas governments seem to be dragging their heels. Is there any particular reason why governments are not attacking this problem?
I could answer that. So there's been an international agreement, essentially, since 1970s, in the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which involves UN 190-odd countries agreeing under the Kyoto Agreement that they would do something to restrict carbon emissions. And then going ahead, we had the meeting in Paris. So I'm losing track of time now. Was that 2015? In which there was an extraordinary unanimous agreement of all the countries that they would do their best to keep global temperatures to below 2 degrees and increase, and preferably below 1.5 degrees. So it looked like everything was going in the right direction. But it requires countries not only to commit to doing something, but also actually doing something.
Yeah.
And what we had in Glasgow was the Glasgow United Nations meeting last year was some enhancement of what you could call ambitions in terms of reducing emissions, but actually precious little action. And I think nowadays the international situation is such that countries have got taken their eye off the ball. Yeah. Although, as you said right at the beginning, it's an existential crisis. So if they don't do something about it, you know, wars in Ukraine will not pale into insignificance, but certainly, you know, not be any larger than the effects of climate change on global health and well-being and existence.
Yeah. Yeah. The way that things are going at the moment then is pretty poor. There is progress, but not enough progress. Effectively, with climate change, we're in a situation where there is a potential, as I understand it, for it to be accelerated by the processes that are currently in action. And what I'm speaking of here is as you warm places like Siberia, you release methane from the soil, and that then helps to make things even worse and release more methane and so on and so forth. Is this a major problem, or am I exaggerating a minor part?
So what you're talking about is called generally tipping points.
Yeah.
And there are a number of tipping points that have been proposed that could tip the climate into a different mode, which is assumed to be much worse situation for humans. Several of these are being monitored. One, as you say, is methane from permafrost. Another one is the ice that I was talking about earlier, whether or not
melting,
the polar ice will come back, or whether it's going to go away and stay away. Another one is tropical deforestation. At the moment, you know, it grows back every summer, but you could get into a situation where it just died and went away.
Yeah.
You've got things like changes in the ocean circulation. So if you ever saw that wonderful film The Day After Tomorrow, it starts with snow in various places and people in the British Antarctic Survey. And the idea of that was that the global overturning circulation of the ocean had stopped. And so the poles were getting much colder.
Yeah.
And this is something else. So the global meridional overturning circulation of the ocean has been measured possibly to be slowing down. Certainly nowhere near stopping at the moment, but this is something that, again, people have got their eyes on. So there's a number of these tipping points. At the moment, it doesn't look like we're actually very close to any of them, which is probably
a good thing.
But certainly there's an awareness that they might happen in the future.
So each of those tipping points would effectively accelerate some of the problems that we're talking about. I mean, methane would accelerate global warming.
Yeah.
And if the Gulf Stream stopped working for any reason in the North Atlantic, Britain would get colder, but other places would get much warmer.
Yes, exactly, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think this then sort of brings us very easily back to one of Olivia's favourite questions, which is climate deniers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Of course, it's going to be its own barrier in itself, isn't it? And of course, with politicians that are spouting the climate change isn't something to worry about, and everybody online is always going to be those sort of arguments, and especially with modern technology, these arguments seem to be getting louder. What sort of reasons would you say that they would have to deny climate change and the evidence involved?
Well, there's been climate change deniers at least since the 1970s, when the American scientists and indeed European scientists were doing the first work on the CO2 greenhouse effect and what would happen to the climate. And the denial in those early days amounted to people dismissing the science as somehow flawed. And there was actually funding for, I don't know, scientists, companies or whatever, to write papers saying that the science was flawed, and thereby nobody should take any notice of it. There are still people trying to quibble at the edges, arguing that carbon dioxide is only in concentrations of a few hundred parts per million, all sorts of things. Water vapor is a bigger greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, etc., etc., etc. We have answers to all those questions. We know exactly what's going on and why it's going on. But the deniers will carry on spouting that stuff and playing it up, especially on these conspiracy theory websites, which want to suggest that there's some sort of international body of scientists who are, it's in their interests to keep their grants coming in by working on climate change. So the conspiracy theorists. I think there's also, of course, rather obviously, self-interest from fossil fuel companies and things. So while I think that they were in the past trying to hide the evidence, they're not trying to hide it anymore. They're trying to make new arguments. I think the most popular one is, we need fossil fuels to carry on while we adapt to our new situations. We've got to carry on digging new oil wells and et cetera, et cetera. And that's obviously, I mean, it's obvious in their own interest. So you'd say, well, why wouldn't they, really? I think there's fear, just fear from people who see all the stuff, the Extinction Rebellion and the climate programs, and they're scared. And of course they're scared because it's horrible, and that they're in a position of denial because they don't want to know. They don't want to know about it, and so they don't want to act as if it's real. And then I'll say finally, but the last one I can think of is occurs, and you see it's interesting that a lot of the dislike of action comes from the right wing. And this is not me making a political statement, it's an observation of the Republican Party in the US, of the extreme conservatives here. And I think it amounts to an inherent dislike of regulation. So they don't want to be told what to do, especially by green lefties like environmental scientists. But anyway, they don't want the government telling them that they can and can't do things if it affects their way of life and their way of business. And of course you can't do stuff about climate change without some sort of regulation. Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of talk about everybody should fly less and drive less, and of course they should, but that's not going to be enough without governments across the globe setting down laws or at least taxes or some way of stopping it.
One of the problems here, I guess, is social media, in the sense that social media is spreading quite a lot of this disinformation and conspiracy. There's very little we can do about that, I would guess. So are we on a losing wicket all the way through? It's just not worth even trying.
That's a much bigger question than climate change, and the climate is what I work on. But if you look at people and the anti-vax movement, it's just not in the interests of humanity. But people latch on to these extraordinary ideas, and any sort of quotes evidence that comes in their direction, they will put it on their website. Nobody's moderating it. It's all building out of control, and people think that what they read on websites is the truth. And unfortunately, much of it is complete and utter garbage. But I don't know how the likes of you and me do anything about it apart from writing to Elon Musk. Well, he's not going to take any notice, is he?
Of course.
It's the governments that got to act, and they've got to say that websites that publish misinformation, disinformation, harmful stuff have got to be closed down.
Of course, there's so much, I don't want to call it propaganda, but it might as well be, of large oil companies almost blaming the individual person, saying, think about your carbon footprint, think about recycling. But how much of an impact does the individual person actually have in terms of climate change in comparison to these large organizations?
I think it's tiny, but that's not to dismiss personal actions, partly because you can have a local influence, and secondly, and I think perhaps more importantly, it inculcates a sense of ownership and responsibility and understanding of what's going on. And if you're thinking, I'm doing my bit by turning the heating down, then everybody else should be doing their bit, and the government should definitely be doing their bit. And I think it helps to get things in motion. So I would certainly encourage personal action. And actually, on that point, it's an interesting result that almost anything you can do to act on climate change is also good for your health. So, for example, burning less fossil fuels means there's less black particulates in the area, in the air, which makes it much better for breathing and lung disease and that sort of thing. Walking or biking instead of going in your car, it's good for your health. Improving green open spaces, it's good for your health, both mental and physical. I'm trying to think of other examples now.
Cutting back meat.
Yes, absolutely. That's good for heart troubles and that sort of thing. You know more about it than me, I expect. Certainly. a healthy diet would be one way of putting that. It's certainly a good thing. And reducing energy usage, especially given the current costs, not only reduces fossil fuel emissions should you be using oil or coal, it's also good for your bank balance and your budget. So that's good for your mental health.
That's brilliant. Mm-hmm.